talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903.
Running with the night, playing in the shadows, kind of work we do here at Coast to Coast AM. Charles Ostman is my guest. We're talking about nanotechnology, and coming up in just a second, the possible dark side of the little stuff. You know, success, and history forgive a lot of things. And the world just barely remembers that when we were about to harness the power of the atom, applied first, I might add, to a bomb, of course we were in a world war, and there were perhaps a million lives at stake. Nevertheless, there was a very strong body of scientific feeling at the time that if we exploded an atomic bomb in the atmosphere, there was a pretty significant possibility that the entire atmosphere, according to the scientists at the time, might virtually explode in a chain reaction, that we might start a chain reaction that would envelop the entire world and destroy all of us. That really was a strong scientific opinion at the time. Nevertheless, with the pressure of the war and all the rest of it, and for whatever reason, we pressed the button. And it's not the only example of that kind of science that we've done. We have virtually erased people's immune systems with AIDS and introduced the immune system of other animals into that human being with potentially deadly results for all of humanity. Not that it happened, nor did the entire atmosphere explode, but with nanotechnology, gray goo, and no doubt endless other possibilities, there comes that moment when a scientist, Charles, has a choice of pressing a button with perhaps unknown, unpredictable results. Inevitably, the button gets pressed.
Well, I think about this a lot, Art. In fact, I've served on several committees in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere with exactly these thoughts in mind. Mm. So it's not like we're just sort of blindly charging into this. In fact, I've talked to Bill Joy a number of times. He's the person, of course, that authored the very famous article that kind of was the first real warning on the horizon. A Wired magazine published him, and he's a very brilliant guy. I really respect him a lot.
Gray Goo?
He talked about Gray Goo, and he talked about sort of a complete collapse of socioeconomic infrastructure if suddenly nanotech, you know, got out of hand.
Yes.
And yet he also recognized that this is a two-edged sword, as with all technologies. And I might just offer a little caveat before I mention the ones that I'm most afraid of. I tend to view evolution as a kind of a trauma-induced process. Now, that sounds a little weird, but my explanation is that given that the periodicity and amplitude of the trauma cycles don't exceed the system's capacity to respond, it will come back more robust. And it happens in human experience. It happens throughout all of nature.
Wait. I think what you're saying to me right now is, look, if something awful happens, it just might be a wonderful evolutionary leap, even though it kills millions of people.
I didn't say a wonderful evolutionary leap. I'm saying that we are addressing a challenge.
Yeah.
And the challenge is to either have the spiritual wisdom, and I use those words carefully, to understand what we're dealing with and use it wisely, or we will perish at our own folly.
All right. The things you are most afraid of with regard to this technology.
Okay, the two areas that I'm most focused on.
Yes.
Proteomic selection, and I'll explain what that is.
Please.
Or proteomic targeting, as it's often called. And the other one, which I would call selective disassembly.
Okay. Selective disassembly. Let's start with that.
Okay.
I understand that a little. Selective disassembly.
Sure. And think of it like this. In fact, when the movie Andromeda Strain came out many years ago, which I thought was kind of a cool film, it was a little bit ahead of its time, but it had the right idea. If you remember, the very first scene in the film, they show a jet pilot flying around up in the upper atmosphere, and all of a sudden his gear starts to dissolve. I mean, like his face mask, his oxygen mask, the windshield of the aircraft starts falling apart and he dies.
I remember.
And so that was actually a particularly interesting snapshot of this concept, even though this film came out, I believe, in the mid-60s. It was kind of leaning in that direction. So now we actually have, I think, within a handful of years perhaps, the ability to begin to unravel how this could actually be done. And I think that the target goal could be, and I'm not saying it's going to be done, but I'm saying that there are people looking at this, what if a weapon system could be developed that could, say, target mission-critical materials in vehicles, could disable a tank or disable a truck or maybe even bring an aircraft down, because you could target specific chemistries within that structure and then dissolve them on the spot using some kind of a nano device, if you will, or a nanite system.
Are you saying that an aircraft could just basically eat itself up, vaporize?
Maybe not the whole aircraft, but certain key components, if you knew what chemistries you're looking for, exactly.
Well, it wouldn't take many key components to...
That's exactly right. The more complex the system, the more fragile it becomes. That's exactly right. And so imagine now, especially organic materials, the rubbers and the plastics and all the special materials for the gaskets and all that kind of thing.
Of course.
If you let loose the right kind of sort of quasi-viral component like nano devices, I'll just throw it out as a word, that could instantaneously begin to dissolve these or break these things down to the point where they rupture or fail, yes, that would be exactly the target goal. The problem with this idea, as I'm sure many people are thinking, is, well, wait a second, that may sound good for a theoretical battlefield concept, but what other stuff sort of gets loose or just...
Yeah. In other words, if you construct something that eats rubber away, and fine, gaskets and seals fail, an airplane comes quickly out of the sky, but then this same stuff somehow doesn't get the end-of-job instruction.
Exactly right, and this is precisely where I have had some particularly heated discussions saying... This is not an area we want to be going in, but, you know, I mean, what can I say? I'm just one voice amongst many. But that is an area where I think if there was, and let me continue on in a sort of a specific vein with this, because here in this country, in the United States, I think there are a lot of good people who are trying very, very hard, and I mean quite literally the best that they can do, to come up with reasonable protocols and industrial sort of safety codes and that kind of thing to make sure this stuff really doesn't get too crazy.
Yes.
However, elsewhere in the world, maybe like in China, for instance.
Maybe like
that.
In China, yeah.
Where they don't really have environmental regulations or health or safety codes or any of this stuff at all, not that we would recognize them anyway. They don't have limitations, I use that word kind of carefully, on how they judge the efficacy of these concepts.
Let me tell you something real quick, Charles. I got a call this morning from Bob Crane. Hmm. He's one of my advertisers.
Sure.
He's in Shenzhen, China right now.
Huh?
He said you can't breathe.
Yeah, well, I understand.
He said that right now it's so bad that your eyes water. Everything you have waters. You sneeze all the time. It's not. It's almost not breathable air for human beings.
I understand. In fact, it's kind of like Soylent Green, sort of in a way, already taking place in China.
Yeah.
It's a very sad and very telling example of a failure of sorts.
Okay,
evolutionary challenge.
So we've established what they're doing over there right now. They surely are not going to be particularly careful if they start. What's China doing with nanotechnology? Anything?
They're doing a lot.
They're
spending big money on this. And in fact, you know, I live right just down the street from the University of California in Berkeley, and I can tell you just from personal knowledge, you know, I would say probably 15% of the population there, at least if not more, is from Asia. And the vast majority of these students are in, you know, chemistry, physics, and sort of different tangential areas of nanotechnology. And if you look at the publications of papers, if you look at the technical documents that come out in the various trade journals and scientific journals, an ever-increasing number are coming right out of China, or certainly out of Chinese nationals who, of course, will go back to China once they finish their education here.
Uh-huh.
And this is exactly where they're going. They see this. Now, China, for a lot of different, we could spend hours talking about China, but, I mean, they clearly are the most aggressive industrialization ramp-up in history that we know of. And clearly they see nanotechnology as their pathway to getting into, let's say, alternative energy, different kinds of manufacturing domains, you know, et cetera. I mean, they see it as a commercial venture, obviously, but I have no doubt There's a military side to this.
Well, there's a military side to it, and there's also a private sector side that's not going to be nearly as careful as we are, and I'm not convinced we're that careful.
The one check I might offer, and forgive me for interrupting, but at least here we have the potential for litigation. That is, if something gets ridiculously out of hand, the companies are afraid of getting sued out of existence.
Yeah, well,
again, elsewhere, that's not the case.
You can't sue the dead, though.
Well, I agree with you there. I'm not defending this at all. I'm just saying this is kind of what is.
No, I've got that. But, I mean, if selective disassembly became mass disassembly...
This could be a very bad thing. I am truly on your side with this. And so I'm not suggesting we want to do this, but I'm saying it's a possibility.
All right. With the fact in mind that China might not have all the same cautions in place that we do, how worried are you?
I think it's something to be concerned about, not tomorrow, but maybe in 5 or 10 years. I mean, people could start experimenting with this stuff, and we wouldn't even know it. Here's the real rub with nanotech, if I could just back away a little bit, just a larger view.
Sure.
If you look at, for instance, the nuclear threat, which is all... When I was engaged in Star Wars projects myself personally, that was the big deal. We were afraid of incoming, you know, rockets from Russia, that kind of thing.
Yes.
So we were designing particle beams and lasers and that kind of stuff to deal with it. Okay, fine. At least there was a kind of a simpler world. We knew what the enemy was, we knew what they were going to do, and we had some ways to counteract that.
That's right.
With nuclear technology in general, you can see what's going on. Even with Iran and so forth now, we can tell what they're doing. We can measure it, we can see it, we sort of know what's going on. With this nano stuff, you can't really see anything. I mean, it could be easily hidden away inside of an office building or in an ordinary-looking, even a domestic house of some sort. I mean, it doesn't take a big, giant facility with lots of infrastructure.
I'm not so convinced, Charles, we know what's going on.
I agree with you, Art. I think there's a lot going on. We can only guess that.
It's not like we had it all down pat before we went to war with Iraq.
I agree with you, Art. We're on the same page. And that's a good metaphor to suggest how far off our intelligence really can be. And there we were going for something kind of simple, you know, big chemistry, big nuclear, that kind of stuff.
Hmm.
This new generation of stuff could literally be hidden away anywhere. And so this is going to be a very difficult thing to keep track of. I agree.
Nanotechnology is something that can be done in a little lab way underground.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't radiate that I know of.
Correct. You're correct. Yeah, that's right.
So there's no real way to trace it as we might nuclear devices.
Exactly right. That was the point I was trying to make, and you said that very well.
All right. The first thing you talked about was selective disassembly. That was the second thing. I'm sorry. What was the first
proteomic
thing?
Proteomic targeting is the other one.
What is that?
Okay, well, this is more of a nanobiology world, but the two sort of overlap. And proteomic targeting, this is one of those interesting examples where it could be a spectacular medical breakthrough, it could be a horrible weapon. It both come at the same time. So here's how this really works. And in fact, oddly enough, just to give you some background, I spoke with Dr. Ken Allebeck, who I think you've had on your show before. He was the Supreme Director of Bioweapon Development for the Soviet Union before he defected in 1994, and he wrote a book called Biohazard, which goes into great detail about the Soviet program at the time. But to kind of give a background, the original theme of biowarfare was to create horrible microbes that could do awful things, basically by modifying existing microbes that would generally be released to the general population. Proteomic targeting says that you make a much more selective microorganism that goes for specific genetic traits.
For example?
Like a racial trait, people of a certain racial proclivity. You could key on anything that could be genetically mapped, could be theoretically targeted by the right kind of designer, I'll call it a quasi-viral component for a better choice of words. And a virus, just to let the audience kind of get a picture of this, what a virus does really, like a hand to a glove, it has a proteomic surface, it's like a chemical coating,
right,
that specifically matches, because of the RNA structure involved, with the exact kind of cell that you're looking for. Now, the reason this is interesting is because in medicine, for instance, the real problem with today's medicine, for the most part, is that you have to put into the bloodstream or put into the body a compound that hopefully will correct some kind of physiological problem. Usually, though, the end result of that is it causes other problems that you have to correct for with, you know, more drugs to counteract the results of the first drugs and so on. With proteomic targeting, you could very precisely say just go to that one kind of cell.
Yeah.
And in fact, go into that cell and only affect one part of the cell and then do something that's interesting. This is a huge medical breakthrough. This could completely revolutionize healthcare as we know it to be.
All right, weaponize.
The flip side is, if you weaponize this and you said, I don't like people of, I don't know, Arab descent or African origin or something, whatever. I mean, you could just take a racial proclivity that you don't like.
Yes.
And then look for those genetic markers. Yes, it could be really, really bad. And the really awful part is microbes, especially viruses, tend to mutate on their own. You were talking about unexpected consequences. Well, this is just the kind of unexpected consequence that could really be the worst of all possible things, because if you begin to build these kinds of designer delivery systems, where you're hoping to kill off a population and then sort of step in and take over their territory, who's to say that that thing you just hatched wouldn't mutate into something else that you didn't expect? This could be, you know, the human race could find its ultimate demise rather quickly if a kind of a nanobiological weaponry approach were taken by somebody that we didn't even know were developing it, as an example.
Well, I know that there are Islamic fundamentalists right now.
Absolutely.
Who, if they did have something that would target
white people or something, you know,
white
whatever.
People,
yeah, sure.
They wouldn't hesitate for a second.
I know.
Remember, I said extremists.
Yeah, I understand that.
And I hate to say this, but if the United States government wasn't working on a very similar,
I sense what you're getting at. Let me see if I can help this process. What I do know is this: that many people are extremely worried about this, and so we're trying to come up with remedies. That is, ways to predictively sense or detect things that we don't know exist yet. This is the problem with biowarfare in general. It's one thing to have a genetic library of the bad microbes you're hoping to detect and therefore somehow protect against or have some kind of remedy for.
May I ask a question, please? If something like this was concocted and released to kill all the white people in the world or the black people in the world, whatever.
Yeah, sure, exactly.
How quickly could it work?
Depends on the delivery mechanism, but if it was an airborne solution that was extremely virulent, it could be weeks or a month or two. I mean, it could be pretty quick. And here's one of the other, if you look at epidemiological trends in today's world, there was a woman named Lori Garrett who wrote a very good book about this a few years ago, and she went into exhaustive detail to map up precisely the acceleration of epidemic trends as we see them. And it's a combination of changing climate, changing population densities, people traveling much more than they used to in times past. In other words, in a previous era, if something broke out, it would sort of stay in that one area for a length of time. Nowadays, it could be overnight because somebody could be on a plane that wouldn't even know that they had the thing in question.
That's right.
And this stuff could spread almost overnight. And the problem is that if you don't know what you're looking for, if there's no genetic signature to say this is the bad microbe and therefore we need to come up with a vaccine or some way to kill it, then you don't know what you're dealing with until it's already too late. That's the real...
Well, that's what I was concerned about.
Yeah, that's the question mark that nobody has an answer for.
And how do you? I understand that you want to build protections against these things, but they're going to be so specifically technologically detailed that it's going to be all over by the time we come up with the defense. Or is there some sort of general antibiotic for this sort of thing?
There is not that I know of. Look, I'm not a specialist, by the way, in biopathogens from this perspective. That's not my background. But I will say this much. One thing that might be interesting to your audience, and in fact, George Norrie has made this point several times, I find it extremely interesting that over the past couple, 3 years, a number of microbiologists and people who specialize in precisely this area of science have all been killed in kind of strange ways.
I know.
I'm not a conspiracy guy, but I say, looking at this from the surface, I go, this is interesting. And if one were to take this a step further and say, well, why would somebody be organizing the murder or disposing of all these specialists, it would be with this kind of objective in mind, in my opinion.
In other words, concern about this.
Concern about this, or more importantly, the flip side is if somebody were planning something that is a release of something horrible, the first step would be to remove those people who could invent an antidote.
Well, of course, whenever a microbiologist or somebody in one of these fields is in some strange way leaving this earth, it's widely flashed around the Internet. So I'm not sure if it's a disproportionate number of people who are coming to disagreeable ends or not, or whether we just hear about it a lot on the Internet. I haven't made up my mind about that yet. Have you?
Well, it's funny. I was actually at the Bio 2004 conference last year, which is a huge conference. It's the largest biotech conference in the world. If you go to bio.org, you can get a download of all this.
30 seconds.
Sure. I went to the security seminar within that conference and had a few moments with some of the top security chiefs in the sort of bio-defense world.
And they were talking about it?
They had this on their mind. It was not exactly an unknown topic.
All right. So it's not just internet traffic. Those who know about these kinds of things in these fields are noting, boy, that's pretty serious. If true, that worries me. How about you? From the high desert in the middle of the night, I'm Art Bell.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
We keep coming upon these incredible things that can either save us or kill us. And we keep having these choices. Well, nanotechnology is the newest in this category of things that may save us or kill us. At the moment, we're sort of talking about the dark side. Now, that's perhaps not something we should spend a whole lot of time on. It is a very, very dark side. I'm sure you'll see movies made and all the rest about the dark side. The upside is very optimistic. I mean, it could do incredible things for mankind, and we're going to talk about those, too. In a few moments, I'm going to invite you all to ask questions of Charles Ostman. That's one good way to slow him down, is to let you all ask him specific questions. This is a really fascinating topic because it's now. Nanotechnology is breaking out all over the place, and it's for real. It's not science fiction. Some aspects of it perhaps are, but it's really underway. I mean, it's not just written about, thought about, imagined. It's actually underway right now, and it may change our world if it doesn't destroy it.
Well, this is the way of things, and you had it exactly right with your previous comment. This is just another step in our potential evolution, but we have to somehow, and this may be impossible, but in my way of looking at it, we need to have a kind of a spiritual evolution in sync with our technical evolution. This may be a challenge that is seen in many other worlds, and we're just one of many worlds that goes through this trial and error process.
Okay. What weapon have we invented that we haven't used?
Oh, gosh.
Or tested.
I'm not sure I'm supposed to talk about this. I forgive me. I wasn't expecting that kind of a question.
It's a good question.
It's a wonderful question. I'll say this much. The weapons that I know of, I'll just keep it that way, are for the most part defensive. I mean, the United States...
Are these weapons you can talk of or know of or can talk of, can't... How much classified stuff do you know?
Oh, some areas. I've spoken at some DARPA conferences. I have signed some papers from time to time, non-disclosure agreements, this kind of thing. I used to carry a clearance, but I haven't carried a clearance for quite a few years. But I still have friends in certain areas that we talk. But I want to make a point really clear. For the most part, the stuff that I know of is basically defensive. That is, most of the research that I have seen some examples of are ways to counteract something horrible happening. That's not to say, however, that elsewhere in the world, the opposite is being sort of the primary objective.
How could we not be working on offensive weapons in this field? How could we not be? That's what I kind of started to ask you earlier.
That's a fair question. I think the most interesting or most spectacular is the antimatter weapon that the Air Force quietly admitted they were developing. I've seen some evidence of that.
You think we have an antimatter?
I think we're trying to get one, yes. Absolutely.
What would an antimatter weapon do?
It would make a really big blast with no radioactive signature.
A really big blast.
I mean, this would make a hydrogen bomb look small by comparison.
And it wouldn't have
a bunch of dirty materials left over as a result.
Great.
If you want to obliterate a portion of a continent, I guess that may be over-exaggerating, but I mean, that would be sort of the context.
Without making it unusable for countless years.
That's right, exactly, yeah.
We're having a big controversy right now. You may have seen some of the recent headlines with regard to Yucca Mountain.
Oh, absolutely. That's
and
a horrible
some decision. Of those emails are absolutely worrisome.
Yes, I agree. I worked back in the mid-70s, back in Carter's time, right here at Lawrence Lab. We were trying to figure out then what to do with nuclear waste. We didn't have an answer, by the way.
I think we still don't.
I agree with you. And this is a very tricky thing to work with, because in the pure ideological world, nuclear power is actually a good solution for energy.
I fully understand that.
The problem is that, A, the plants are not that reliable, and, B, the waste is undisposable. So what do you do? I mean, I thoroughly agree. And I also got wind recently that there was some debate about some potential fake documents being produced in terms of Yucca Mountain.
That's what I was talking about.
And, this is not the first time this has been done. You know, sometimes people in their little political empires, all they want to do is see a result that suits their political interest. They're not really interested in the larger picture. And this is a classic example of just that kind of, unfortunate aspect.
Unfortunate aspect. This is material we're going to have to keep safe for a minimum of 10,000 years. We haven't done anything for 10,000 years.
I know. And in fact, if you want to see a good example of how bad things can go, just try visiting Chernobyl, because I have friends that actually have been to the Ukraine, and they've gone there for that very reason. Chernobyl is a kind of a very unfortunate but very viable sort of a test bed, like a Petri dish, to show what can happen when a lot of nuclear waste suddenly gets dumped into the water table.
What is the truth of how it's going at Chernobyl? I mean, I've seen specials, I've heard rumors, I've heard reports, but I've heard that the sarcophagus is disintegrating, I've heard there could be an explosion, I've heard all kinds of awful stuff.
I don't know about an explosion, but yeah, the concrete has a lifetime of X, and under radiation it falls apart, as most materials do, by the way.
Yes.
But that's not the real problem. The real problem is what's already happened, and it's very sad. The Ukrainian people are wonderful people. They're very strong, very tough, and very smart, and yet they've had a horrendous situation to deal with, because this stuff has gone into the water table, it's gone into the farming situation, it's appearing in milk, it's appearing in the fruits and vegetables, hundreds of miles away. They're still getting, readings off the scale. And so the results are cancers and immune efficiencies, like AIDS, as it were, caused by the radiation in some context.
Well, it's been a lot of years now. Do we have any estimates, or has it all been hushed up, of the reality of how many deaths it's caused, how many cancers?
Yeah, yeah, no, it's a good question, because it's very complicated. The politics is very complicated, and I'm not qualified to go into detail about Ukrainian politics, but there's a lot of concern about panic and about, I mean, the Ukrainian economy's had a really tough time, and so the last thing they want to do is broadcast, you know, how serious the circumstance really is, because they're trying to attract investment. And,
right.
You know, so, I mean, it's complicated. There is no clear answer for that. It's not good, I can say that much. And so should we be looking at something like that here? Well, to take a place like Yucca Mountain, which is right near where you are, I know the area well, and say, okay, this is safe, there's no damage or potential or whatever, is ludicrous. I don't know where you could put this stuff that would be safe. You're right. We don't have a 10,000-year period of history where anything's been stable for that long. That's a question that I'm not sure I have an answer for.
Or can give.
Or can give, yeah.
Uh-huh. All right, a few questions. We're going to start peppering you with questions. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Charles Hausman. Good morning.
Hello, Mr. Bell.
Hi.
I just want to say that I've enjoyed your show for many years, and I really appreciate your show.
Thank you.
My name is Clint, and I'm from Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Okay.
And can I mention an author's name in regards to the show tonight or not?
An author's name, yes, I guess.
Michael Crichton, book Prey.
I know the book all too well, sadly.
I read the book, and it was very intriguing, but I had a couple of questions. One was in regards to nanotechnology's use in medicine. You touched on it in use of pointing out or attacking certain illnesses. It also repair?
Yes, that's exactly right. In fact,
like an aneurysm?
Well, let me explain a little bit further, if I may. I actually testified to the FDA last year on exactly this topic, and what I testified about was the following. And hopefully I can answer the question directly, but here's what I'm leading up to. In current regulatory or compliancy codes, as the FDA dictates, there's two very distinct but separate areas of medicine. One's to do with chemistry, that is drugs, which you inoculate to hopefully change a condition. The other is in machines or devices. Where nanotechnology comes in is sort of combining the two. We're now looking at very specifically sort of molecule-sized things, like little machines almost, that really can go in and, in fact, correct for a situation before it even happens.
I'm curious, Charles, if such a thing, a little machine, existed, would that little machine be classified as a pharmaceutical, or would it be classified... I mean, it's not a chemical.
Well, this is exactly why the FDA was having these discussions, because they don't know. They're trying to figure that out as we speak. That is exactly the question that they have posed before them.
So they're not sure.
Well, and they're trying to sort this out. So let me give you an example as kind of a pinprick, if you will.
Aneurysm. He mentioned aneurysm.
Okay,
it's
aneurysm.
A good question.
Well, I'm gonna steer you towards one area of chemistry that might be sort of interesting. There's something called dendrimers, and these are large molecules which look like a large branching structure. That's why they're called dendrimers. But the reason they're interesting is because they can be packed up with lots of other materials inside them. They have an unbelievable capacity for holding other materials. And yet, because of the chemistry involved, they're biologically friendly. So they look like a protein in a way. And in fact, you can coat the outside with very specific enzymes and proteolytic materials so that you can go after something like an aneurysm or some other targeted region within the body and say, okay, go there and then do something interesting. So whether it's to open up a cell and stop it like a cancer cell, or to change, say, blood flow in a certain region, or to modify the behavior of some physiological process, that's exactly what they're doing as we speak. In fact, there's a couple of companies who are now beginning to produce these dendrimer systems as a delivery mechanism for these kinds of problems.
But still undetermined whether it's a machine and outside the purview of the FDA, what a mess that's going to be for them.
It's not exactly a mess, but it's a very strange new area of science. And I'll give you an example. One of the companies I happen to know of quite well, they went to Australia because Australia said, well, we're not quite so finicky about how we're going to regulate this. We would like to see if this is even possible. So as a kind of an end run around the somewhat slower process that we have here, they went to Australia so they could start human trials within about 3 or 4 years.
Wow.
But exactly, this is what's happening. In other words, the idea of medicine just being a chemical is quickly being replaced by sort of a combination of chemo-mechanical, I guess you might say, solutions.
Chemo-mechanical, that's a good way to put it, I suppose. So in countries where it's not quite so restricted, again, like China.
And Taiwan is a good example as well.
And Taiwan. Who knows what might come? The problem is that allowing them to have this sort of free reign, not that we can stop them, could be to our distinct disadvantage, couldn't it?
For a number of reasons. Commercially, if the biotech world, and I use that word kind of carefully, but the sort of nanobiology, medicine, biotech arena, they sort of all merge together, people are going to start going to where they can find medical solutions.
You bet.
And, you know, I mean, if I had cancer and I thought I could go to Taiwan to get one of these new sort of nano solutions, yeah, of course I'd go there.
You'd be on your way.
The flip side says, could the same general direction technology end up becoming some kind of a weapon that we don't even know about?
Of course.
That's the flip side of that coin, yeah.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Good morning.
Good morning, all right. Good morning to your guest and good morning to the listening audience. All right, for biotechnology is concerned, it is suggested that the AIDS virus was manufactured in that vein. There is a website that kind of stipulates that.
I'm not going to allow you to put it on the air, but okay.
Okay, I won't do that.
Thank you.
Put it on the air.
Thank you.
But I will say this. Seems like there seems to be a heavy proclivity for the AIDS virus to affect black people other than other races because we're no more promiscuous than anybody else. And it seems to have been, according to this website, seems to have been manufactured to affect a particular race. Look at how it's devastating Africa. For what your guests say to that?
Well,
at it, Charles.
Okay,
he's right.
This is a good question. And there's a person named Rillette Smith who I've known for many years. I met him at Stanford many years ago, who's an African person himself. He's one of the leading specialists in sort of unusual epidemiological situations, and he's looked at AIDS, and he's also looked at prions very carefully. Now, whether AIDS was a manufactured virus specifically could be a debate, but it did somehow get from monkeys, which is where it was originally thought to have originated, and into the human population. So the story goes. And there were a lot of people who kind of theorized that going back about 20 years or so, there were a number of countries, U.S., France, Russia, you name it, who were kind of tinkering with biowarfare possibilities.
Yes.
A lot of them got a certain way into it and then said, wait a minute, this stuff's too dangerous because we don't know what the end result could be.
Listen, you can go back and get the minutes of some congressional hearings, Charles.
Yes.
I know you know this.
Yes.
Where essentially, to be honest with you, AIDS was discussed. They didn't call it AIDS necessarily, but they said exactly what it would do.
Yes, they wanted to be able to, in a controlled way, suppress the immune system. And, should they have found the virus available in a monkey with a little bit of modification to see if it could be spread to the human population, it's certainly a possibility. I won't deny that it's not possible. I don't have any specific evidence, but I wouldn't rule it out. I couldn't, in good conscience, rule it out.
God,
I don't know where things, you know, and this is the weird thing. A lot of people are trying really hard to figure out what to really do, because if AIDS was a early kind of primitive example of how
imagine what they could do now.
Yeah, exactly. So believe me, people are thinking about this carefully. I mean, they were trying as much as they can.
All right, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Hello.
Hi, Art. Hi, Charles. This is Lori. How are you?
Okay.
I guess you guys kind of covered my question a couple callers ago, but I just, going back to the positive biological implications of this, it was explained to me that it's like people are working on microscopic robot-type things that can be introduced into the body almost as an army to fight, like, cancer cells. Is that a good way of
Maybe not like little robots, but certainly like, as I said earlier, chemo-mechanical devices, things that go beyond
mechanical, so it's definitely, it's not biological.
Well, yes and no.
Biology and machine that you guys are trying to debate.
Yeah, it's getting fuzzy is right.
It's getting fuzzy because, you know, define life. Well, this is not such an easy thing to do. People like Craig Venter, for instance, can invent life on the fly just as a program, as a software routine. So, I mean, we are at the, let me try a different approach. This may be a little bit far out, but forgive me. if one looks at what, you know, insurance companies, for instance, talk about acts of God, you know, weather, natural cause of death, that kind of thing. Well, the acts of God are becoming ever further and further away from what we used to define as something belonging to out there, because now we can synthetically contrive these things at will.
Uh-huh.
And contriving new life forms is becoming a rote kind of science. So, you know, define life. So the theory is, if we can sort of come up with a quasi-life form-like thing, I'll just put it that way, that can interact with the body's immune system or in some way interact with other systems within the body to help correct for something, that's kind of where it's going. Now, how far that will go and in what context, I can only speak from the perspective of the folks I work with here in this country. Now, elsewhere in the world...
All right, she said tiny robots in the body. That is what it boils down to, isn't it?
In a sense, yes. I mean, a virus is a tiny robot. So
yes.
It's not a machine with little gears and pistons and so forth, but it is a machine of sorts, and that's kind of where things are at as we speak.
So that's a yes, ma'am.
It's so scary, but amazing.
Well, let me try a different approach. One of the areas that I think really is fascinating is in neural interface. That is the ability to interface with the circuitry within the brain and amplify its functions. And this is being done. I mean, in fact, an article just came out a couple of days ago about this fellow who was severely injured in a knife fight. Now he has a chip in his brain so he can think commands to his computer and so forth.
Wait, back up.
Okay, I'm sorry.
A fellow who has a chip in his brain. We're
yes,
talking
indeed.
About something now?
Yes, it's in the Daily News. Now, this has been going on for years. He's just the most recent version of this that's been publicly talked about.
I hadn't heard of this. I mean, we've all heard about it in science fiction. You're telling me there's actually a guy walking around with a chip in his brain? That
this is in Britain. In fact, his last name is Nagel. I can even pull up the article on my computer screen.
What is he able to do?
The basic idea is that he was paralyzed in a knife fight in the year 2001, as I recall.
Yes.
And the idea was that he can now think commands to his computer that controls his body functions, his movements, that kind of thing.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
and,
if he can do that, then why can't a fighter pilot control when to fire a Hellfire missile?
As in the film Firefox, you're right on the right path. In fact, Wright Patterson Air Force Base, I'm not kidding at all, was trying this back in the late 80s. And I can explain more about that if you wish.
You're telling me... all right, hold on, Charles. We're at the top of the hour. Why not? Huh? A pilot sitting with... well, what does he even need a heads-up display for? That's just in front of his brain. And he goes Fox 1 before you can even... Or just as quickly as you can think it, or as quickly as he can think it, and it's all over. I'm Art Bell.